Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. How about that hearing, huh? No, not that one. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, today the 27th day of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You couldn't take your eyes off it, right? The testimony on Capitol Hill today, the threats, the promises, the accusations, and the innuendo. No, not Michael Cohen, not even Fed Chair Jay Powell's hearing. We are talking about the good stuff, trade. U.S. Trade Representative Bob Lighthizer gave the House Ways and Means Committee an update on talks with China this morning. His takeaway was that a meaningful deal is not going to be easy, as Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson reports.
Earlier this week, President Trump said, "We're getting very, very close to a trade deal with China." But for Ambassador Lighthizer, Trump's top trade negotiator, it's not when we get a deal, but if. Lighthizer stressed a deal where China just agrees to buy more U.S. goods isn't enough. It must also tackle big structural issues. And that's a much harder deal to get.
I'm not foolish enough to think that there's going to be one negotiation that's going to change all of the practices of China or our relationship with them. I don't believe that.
The biggest issue, Lighthizer said, is forced technology transfers. U.S. firms being required to share their valuable technology in order to access Chinese markets. Another big question, enforcement. How to hold the Chinese accountable for whatever changes they may agree to. Lighthizer described regular meetings to review Chinese progress. That feels familiar to Scott Kennedy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
It looks a lot like what we had under the Bush and Obama administrations, save for the possibility that the U.S. might be authorized to use unilateral measures should the Chinese not comply.
Lighthizer's priorities are clear, but Kennedy says Trump may prioritize a fast deal over a good one. Nick Consonieri is the director at Rhodium Group. He says if the deal doesn't deliver real changes,
then I think, you know, President Trump's going to be very vulnerable to pushback from a broad set of voices that the past year and a half of tension and trade escalation with China wasn't worth it.
Lighthizer said there's still much work to be done. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
We are going to keep going with that trade theme, domestic this time, not global. The Federal Trade Commission says it is going to start keeping a closer eye on things in tech. Specifically, the agency says it's setting up a task force to investigate anti-competitive conduct. Marketplace's Justin Ho has that one.
The FTC is charged with cracking down on companies that act like robber barons.
For example, when companies are purchased, perhaps just to kill them so that they can't grow into a meaningful competitor in the marketplace.
That's Andrea Matuition, a professor at Northeastern University and a former FTC advisor. The FTC says the new technology task force will review prospective mergers and some mergers that have gone through already. It'll also bring the agency more tech expertise.
Instead of being a half a step behind this very dynamic marketplace, I think they really want to be on the crest of the curve.
David Vladek is a professor at George Washington University and a former FTC director. We don't have many details on how much power the task force will have. Vladek says at minimum, the added scrutiny will make tech companies watch their backs.
If you know you're being watched and you're being watched assiduously by experts at the FTC, you know, you may be more careful.
The move comes at a time when the agency feels pressured to crack down on giants like Facebook and Google, says Adam Thier at George Mason University's Mercatus Center.
Washington is on the warpath for tech companies, with both liberals and conservatives looking to exert more control over the internet.
Still, Thier isn't convinced the agency needs another task force to regulate the sector. He says the FTC already has broad authority to protect consumers, even in the tech world. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this Wednesday, kind of flat, really, once traders digested that news that Lighthizer gave that Tracy was talking about. We will have the details when we do the numbers. I told you yesterday that the answer to the last lingering question from the financial crisis, why didn't anybody go to jail, is complicated. And that getting there is a mix of history and politics. We took you through Countrywide. We went over the savings and loan scandal and Enron. Three crises in all, two of which ended with people in jail and one that didn't. We're going to pick things up today with this observation, that the story of why nobody went to jail after the financial crisis 10 years ago isn't linear. We'll show you how we came to a place where the government overwhelmingly punishes CEOs and institutions not with jail time, but with fines. And we'll explain what happened when the government's try at a prosecution tied to the financial crisis failed. And we'll start today with where this story ends. 6 years after the worst of the crisis, in August of 2014, Eric Holder, who was then the Attorney General of the United States, walked up to a podium at the Justice Department.
The Department of Justice has reached an agreement with Bank of America totaling over $16.6 billion in penalties and consumer relief. This constitutes the largest civil settlement with a single entity in history.
That was the biggie, Bank of America, which, remember we told you yesterday, had bought Countrywide and Merrill Lynch in 2008 as they were going under. But there were more.
J.P. Morgan has agreed to pay $13 billion to the federal
Citigroup has agreed to pay $7 billion to settle federal and state
agreement. Deutsche would make a $4.1 billion consumer relief payment and would also pay a $3.1 billion.
Credit Suisse has also reached a $5.3 billion
Goldman
settlement.
Goldman Sachs will pay $5 billion to settle claims that it duped clients with rotten mortgage investments that Goldman knew were likely to fail.
William D. Cohen is a former Wall Street banker, now turned journalist and author.
This is not the same as justice. This is checkbook justice, and it sets an incredibly bad example. Because in this country, it's really important that people are held accountable for their wrongdoing. And after the financial crisis of 2008, no Wall Streeters were held accountable for their wrongdoing. And perp walks really serve a valuable purpose, especially for white-collar crime, and especially on Wall Street. And the message that was sent by Eric Holder's Justice Department was that these are not crimes, business as usual. You can continue to do things that are wrong and not pay the price. In fact, you can get rewarded for it.
The first moment a lot of people probably started paying attention to the financial crisis and the attendant meltdown of the American economy was in March of 2008, when Bear Stearns was rescued by the Federal Reserve and then bought by J.P. Morgan for $10 a share. Less well-remembered, probably, is a story from later that summer, the Justice Department charging two executives who'd been running a couple of Bear Stearns hedge funds. Not CEOs, to be sure, but still.
In simple terms, it's securities fraud. It was charged in various different ways, but the crux of the crimes that were charged was that these two hedge fund managers reassured their investors that everything was fine, notwithstanding indicators that they had based on their data that showed otherwise.
Eileen Jarislaw is in private practice now, but for years she was an assistant U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of New York.
This was a case the FBI had been investigating very carefully. My understanding is the case was brought to the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York, and they declined to prosecute the case. The FBI then came to the Eastern District of New York, which is just on the other side of the Brooklyn Bridge from the Southern District, and we agreed to take the case.
I need to explain something here for a second. The Southern District of New York is the most well-known office of federal prosecutors in the country. Jobs there are prestigious, and they're competitive. And since it's in Manhattan, the Eastern District is in Brooklyn, it's traditionally been the place where the biggest and highest profile and most important cases wind up. Cases like hedge fund securities fraud in the middle of the biggest financial crisis in generations. Not, though, the prosecution of those two Bear Stearns guys. Do you know why the Southern District passed? And do you know why the Eastern District said yes after the Southern District passed?
I can speculate as to that. I can't say I know the reason. With regard to the Southern District of New York, you may recall there's a famous story that James Comey, when he first became U.S. attorney in the Southern District, had an all-hands meeting. And he asked the prosecutors, raise your hands if you've never lost a case. And a whole bunch of hands proudly shot up. And he said, you folks what we career people call part of the chicken shit club.
Yeah, that James Comey. Before he was fired as director of the FBI by President Trump, Comey was the U.S. attorney for the Southern District back in the early 2000s. And what he meant with that chicken shit thing was that prosecutors who always won just didn't have the guts to roll the dice on the tough, important cases and worried too much about winning or losing them.
I don't know what the discussion was in the Southern District of New York, and I don't pretend to know that. But I do know in the Eastern District of New York, we had a tradition of doing the right thing without regard to whether it was a difficult case or a hard case. I don't take that easy excuse. I think it's the job of a prosecutor to simplify. And we had experts who were very good at educating the jury on what these complex securities were. Yes, it's very complicated. And in order to do these kinds of cases, and I've done many, you do have to simplify them and you have to be a student of the subject area that you're prosecuting.
The trial went 3 weeks and then the jury acquitted.
But jurors acquit for many, many reasons. An acquittal says that at least one or more of the jurors were not convinced beyond a reasonable doubt. That's a very heavy burden. And it's a burden that we embraced in the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of New York. And it's a burden that we weren't afraid of.
So to review, what we have here is a high-profile but unsuccessful prosecution of a couple of Wall Street hedge fund executives at a time when the financial crisis was the biggest story in the country. And there was talk at the time, and has been since, that maybe that acquittal had kind of a chilling effect. Do you suppose that as the financial crisis went on, as further prosecutions were contemplated, people looked back at this case and said, why bother? We couldn't even get a conviction on Bear Stearns.
It's possible, but of course the answer is, I don't know. I've heard that theory. You know, there are 93 U.S. attorneys' offices throughout the land, and it's not that difficult to find venue if you want to bring these cases. You know, the victims were spread throughout the United States and throughout the world. I hope that's not the reason. I think if that was the reason, if the acquittal in this case discouraged others from taking on these cases, I think it's a dereliction of duty. It's the job of the Justice Department to do justice, to do the right thing. And I think it's wrong that just because these defendants are wealthy and they dress nicely and people know people who look like them, that they should be held to a lesser standard. In fact, I would argue these are much more serious offenses, and that for privileged people to get a pass on cases involving millions of dollars is just wrong, and it runs counter to everything I was taught in the U.S. Justice Department.
Whatever the Justice Department taught, that Bear Stearns trial was the last big financial crisis prosecution. Preet Bharara, the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York from 2009 to 2017, he focused the Southern District's work on terrorism. The crisis did happen just 7 years after September 11th, after all. Also, he did civil rights and in finance, insider trading. Here's William Cohen again.
He decided to go after the low-hanging fruit of insider trading, which is, you know, an important area to prosecute wrongdoing in, but frankly, in the scheme of things, not the kind of important prosecution that holding people responsible for the bad behavior that occurred during the financial crisis would be.
We ought to be clear here. There have been finance industry prosecutions and convictions since the crisis. Community bankers, individual mortgage lenders, real estate brokers and developers. Nothing even close to Bear Stearns, though.
But I do think that as a result of losing that case, that was the only case that the Justice Department prosecuted any time after the financial crisis against Wall Street bankers. The possibility of losing, you know, after the Bear Stearns hedge fund case, they obviously decided they didn't want to risk losing and the embarrassment of losing. And as a result, a valuable opportunity to hold people accountable for their wrongdoing was lost and lost forever.
So what happened? Why'd the Justice Department give up on criminal prosecutions? Surprisingly enough, The answer lies in history. Again, the Holder Doctrine, the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, and what happens in the crisis next time is all in Part 3 tomorrow as we wrap things up. Spoiler alert, we are also going to get to the politics of this thing tomorrow. But in the meanwhile, we've got a list of the cast of characters in this financial drama that we are telling, some history as well, also a reading list. And oh yeah, all three parts online right now at marketplace.org. Coming up,
these folks in 30 seconds of script grab you by the throat.
Blame it on Shonda. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 72 points today, about 0.2%, closed at 25,985. The NASDAQ up 5 points, 75.54. The S&P 500 dipped a point, basically flat, 27.92. Weight Watchers lost 34% today, 3.4%. The weight loss company made a worse-than-expected profit forecast, said it hadn't signed up as many subscribers as it had hoped this winter. Planet Fitness, related, unrelated, lifted 2.7% today. Fears over the outcome of U.S.-China trade talks that Tracy was telling us about. Hit some tech companies with big sales in China. Texas Instruments faded 1.4% today. Microsoft gave back about a 0.1%. Electronics retailer Best Buy sparked up 14.1% today. That on quarterly profit earnings that beat analyst expectations. The company also announced a $3 billion stock buyback. That helps, too. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.68%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story. And some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity. A how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. There's a big mobile conference happening over in Barcelona this week, the Mobile World Congress, it's called. It's an annual thing. Everybody's there, including a big delegation from the Trump administration, which is trying to convince Europeans to not let Chinese equipment makers be a part of the continent's next generation infrastructure. 5G is the thing you've been hearing all about. The specific Chinese company in question, Huawei, is, says the White House, a spying and surveillance threat and an arm of the Chinese government. Now, skeptics here might wonder if this whole thing is just a ploy to promote American telecommunications giants. Thing is, there really aren't any. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports on the long, slow decline of American telecommunications dominance.
The origin story in mobile technology is an American one.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Motorola delivered that wireless call from the moon in 1969, just as Hollywood was introducing the notion of handheld phone.
This is smart.
In the TV show Get Smart, Maxwell Smart talks into his shoe.
Hello, Chief. Max. What's up?
In the 1980s, American AT&T was at its height. Dan Hesse ran its equipment division, which was linked to the famed research division Bell Labs.
Which, you know, generated an average of 3 U.S. patents every day, had 6 Nobel Prize winners. So it was the leading telecommunications equipment company in the world.
Fast forward to today, though, and none of the top companies are American. What happened? Well, folks in the business suggest three big factors. Factor one, bad business decisions. In the 1990s, when the first cell phones were bigger than our hands, America saw a telecom building frenzy from Motorola, Lucent, and Nortel. Tom Loria worked at Lucent, where they had a saying.
If you're not lead dog, the view remains the same.
But in this infrastructure race, he says companies went overboard. they overbuilt and overborrowed. And much like the housing bubble, credit dried up and boom went bust.
Ultimately, people typically need one cell phone and one landline, and things sort of did implode.
A second factor? Government policy. In the late 90s and 2000s, when flip phones were all the rage, American cellular carriers spent billions on networks that were incompatible. Remember CDMA, TDMA? If you switched carriers, you had to get a new phone, and the government stayed out. Well, the European Union actively avoided those wars, says analyst Roger Entner at Recon Analytics.
The Europeans made the decision, we will use one standard for every network, and we call that GSM. Everybody rallied around it, and it was just economies of scale that took over.
One big market created telecom titans in Europe, like Nokia in Finland and Ericsson in Sweden. Meanwhile, back in the U.S., a struggling Lucent merged with Alcatel of France.
It was not a very happy marriage, and ultimately, the combined entity was then bought by Nokia.
Eventually, Motorola got bought by Nokia, too. Nortel went bankrupt and sold its assets to Ericsson. Now, this all happened in part because of factor number three, Huawei. The low-priced Chinese competitor emerged onto the world scene right around the time the first iPhone debuted.
Huawei is the standard equipment in emerging markets because for a long time, Huawei charged only half of what Ericsson and Nokia charged.
Huawei critics allege the company has received illegal government subsidies and has stolen Western technology. Either way, it is now the industry leader in mobile infrastructure. Now, it's true that American companies dominate related sectors, Apple in handsets, Google in software, Qualcomm in chips. But former AT&T exec Dan Hesse worries that the underlying network for all of that is non-American and vulnerable.
We run now on internet, telecommunications, and mobile infrastructure. If that source of supply were ever interrupted for political or other reasons, that would be problematic.
The U.S. government and military share that fear now that there's no longer an American Huawei in the industry. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, assuming the sun rises, is going to be Thursday. And to 7 million-ish television viewers, that means just one thing, Grey's Anatomy. An hour's worth of crusading doctors, messy relationships, and no small number of medical miracles, including, if you will permit me to extend the metaphor here, the show itself. Tomorrow, Grey is going to log its 332nd episode, and in so doing will pass ER to become the longest-running primetime medical drama since television has been a thing. We asked Marketplace's Mariel Segarra, a longtime Grey's Anatomy fan, by the way, to explain the staying power.
Why is Grey's Anatomy so popular? Seriously? I bring you Dr. Meredith Grey.
When I met you, I thought I had found the person that I was going to spend the rest of my life with. I was done. So all the boys and all the bars and all the obvious daddy issues, who cared?
These folks in 30 seconds of script grab you by the throat, make you care desperately, and empathize with characters that are often deeply flawed, but facing just tremendous stakes.
Dan Shapiro, a psychologist at Penn State and former consultant for the show, says Grey's is just great drama. But it's more than that. Cam Miller, a TV writer and producer, says from the start, the show featured a diverse cast.
That cast really reflected the world we live in, and people watching could see themselves in that show.
And 15 seasons in, Grey's isn't just surviving. Janine Poggi at Ad Age says a 30-second ad can bring in more than $200,000.
It's actually the eighth most expensive entertainment show in prime time.
Another reason for Grey's success? It's found a new generation of fans on Netflix. That's where Phoebe Merriam, a pre-med student at the College of William and Mary, binge-watches it.
There's a lot of surgery and there's a lot of drama, which are two of my favorite things.
She's on season 8 now. Took a brief pause when one of her favorite characters died. I told her there's a lot more heartbreak in her future. I'm Mariel Segarra from Marketplace.
Honestly, they kind of lost me after they killed off McDreamy. I'm just saying. Yes, spoiler alert, I know. All right, anyway, this final note on the way out today, in which Challenger Gray and Christmas is on it. Challenger is the firm, you might know, that does those work hours lost and thus money that companies lose because of this or that cultural event survey. The NCAA basketball tournament is a perennial example. They figure, based on what they know about how many Americans are interested in politics and who use the internet at work, they're guessing $1.9 billion an hour for this hearing. You figure the thing went, and this is testimony only, like 5 hours, and that's $10 billion. I will point out here that I'm pretty sure my job required me to watch. I'm just saying. And we are out of here. The Dow Industrial's down 72 points today, about 0.2%, basically nothing. The NASDAQ and the S&P 500 both flat. Our media production team includes Sarah Bergere, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday. A little shameless self-promotion here, part three of Why Nobody Went to Jail. Tomorrow, don't miss it. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.